WNF's third annual Peace Awards is Saturday, October 27th at the Straz Center in Tampa this year. Noted Freedom Writers author Ray Arsenault delivers the keynote address, and legendary musician Marty Balin performs. Tickets and information are at WMNF.org. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to bring you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll be discussing chimps, particularly chimps retired from biomedical research, with Andrew Westall, author of a new book on this very topic. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune, a relevant one from the Kinks. This is Ape Man, done live here on Talking Animals.
I think I'm sophisticated because I'm living my life like a good homo sapien. But all around, everybody's multiplying and they're walking on the clouds now. So I'm no better than the animals sitting in their cages in the zoo now. Because compared to the flowers and the birds and the trees, I am an ape man. I think I'm so educated and I'm so civilized and I'm a free vegetarian. Overpopulation and inflation and starvation and the crazy politicians. I don't feel safe in this world no more. I don't wanna die in a nuclear war. I wanna sail away to a distant shore and make my ape man. I'm an ape man, I'm an ape man, no, I'm an ape man. Well, I'm a king called man.
That was the Kinks with a live version of Ape Man, an animal tune of sorts to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Andrew Westall, author of The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, a true story of resilience and recovery, a gorgeously written, often poignant account of Westall's stint living as a volunteer at Fauna Foundation, a sanctuary just outside Montreal for chimpanzees retired from biomedical research. We'll discuss the book, the chimps, and other topics, including pending legislation, very important for the chimps, when we speak with Andrew Westall in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663. Or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Andrew Westall's book, The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary. And we'll speak with Catherine Doyle, In Defense of Animals, Elephant Campaign Director, chiefly about the organization's International Day of Action for Elephants in Zoos, including a demo at Lowry Park Zoo, which we'll also find out about now and then, and we'll speak with Catherine probably as well. All taking place this Saturday, June 11th. Right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements. A look of items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of forthcoming local events. So let's turn now to interesting and or notable developments in animal news. Let's Talk Turkey, as it were. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item isn't really news per se, but it's very much Talking Animals related and WMNF related. By which I mean that WMNF's summer fun drive is tentatively scheduled to start July 12th. And the Talking Animals fun drive show is slated for Wednesday, July 13th, just a little over a month from today. It's very important that we're extremely successful financially on the show here. We need to continue demonstrating the station brass that they made the right decision in expanding Talking Animals to an hour weekly as they did at the beginning of this year. And therefore, that the program is significantly supported in various ways, including financially. In fact, today we received a very generous donation from a, so far, anonymous donor. I'm hoping we can say more about this next week. It just came in this morning, and it's unclear how much detail, if any, she wanted announced on air. Well, I guess we know it's a she now. But anyway, we thank her profusely, and may again be able to thank her more specifically next week. But you can support us now as well via our tip jar. Just go to WMNF.org, and in the schedule, find Talking Animals, obviously on Wednesday at 11 a.m. And then when you click on that page and get to the Talking Animals page itself, in the upper right-hand corner is the tip jar. So if you like the show, you like what we're doing, maybe you could slip in $25, $50, $100, whatever you can swing. More if you can swing it, of course. It all helps us keep the show going and the station going. Or you can also email Duncan at WMF.org now for ways you can pledge your support ahead of time. Before July 13th, we'll get you all set up. And we have some cool thank you gifts to offer, as always, including a week's stay at a Hawaiian condo in the Poipu Beach area on the island of Kauai. Or a really cool special whale watching trip courtesy of Baja Expeditions to hang with the so-called friendly whales in Baja, California. Those are the ones where the mother whales bring the babies up to these little skiffs that you're in to meet and greet and sometimes touch and pet the baby whales. A phenomenon unlike anything else in the world as far as I know. So anyways, for those and others, you can please email Duncan at WMF.org and we will fill you in on what you need to know to get something cool and support WMF and Talking Animals along the way. Meanwhile, on to more directly animal news-related items. Last week, the Fulton County Board of Commissioners, that's in Fulton, Georgia, approved a ban on the use of bullhooks in the county. So, bullhooks are the batons with the sharp metal hook on the end that are used to hit captive elephants in order to keep them fearful and obedient. So now, because elephants traveling to Fulton County can't be jabbed or beaten with these bull hooks, circuses like Ringling Brothers, etc., other traveling shows that use elephants and use, therefore, inevitably, bull hooks, won't be able to perform there. So kind of a cool, hopefully precedent-setting move by the Fulton County folks. Touched on this before, but again, International Day of Action for Elephants is in zoos. It's this Saturday, June 11th. We'll talk more detail about this with Catherine Doyle a little bit later in the show from Defense of Animals. But I wanted to let you know about the local element of that. So this Saturday, June 11th, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the Lowry Park Zoo, there will be a demonstration. And, you know, send a message to the world that it's time to end the suffering of elephants and zoos. You can join in zoos, you can join the Florida Voices for Animals, In Defense of Animals, and Elephant Advocates, actually around the globe, for the International Day of Action for Elephants in Zoos. Global Day of Outreach and Action aimed at bringing attention to the tragic effects of keeping elephants in small, barren zoo pens where they suffer and often die prematurely. So signs and flyers will be provided. You can find out more FloridaVoicesForAnimals.org, and again, more when we speak with Catherine Doyle a bit later in the show. And this was kind of an odd one. It found in the Associated Press that carried in the Washington Post, but I think it was an AP story to begin with. Dateline Hillard, Ohio. Central Ohio Animal Shelter with an abundance of chubby cats is having a sale on its fattest felines, hoping a discount entices potential owners to take one home. The Capital Area Humane Society says the fat cats are on sale this summer for $15 each or two for $20 instead of the usual $70 adoption price. Development manager Mary Heiser says the cats packed on the pounds before arriving at the shelter and the extra weight can cause them health problems. So Columbus Dispatch reports that 9 of the shelter's 55 cats are overweight. Volunteers keep them in an area that offers extra room to run and burn off calories. Also posted this on the Talking Animals Facebook page last night, but hats off to Bob Barker, a previous guest on Talking Animals, who just in a spot, at least I know, as far as I know, released yesterday, is speaking out against SeaWorld and sort of the plight of whales, dolphins, etc., at those things. So it's very easy to find. I'm sure if you search for Bob Barker / SeaWorld, you will find it. It's popped up a number of times already on Facebook by various people. So, and also coming up locally here, Saturday, June 18th, there'll be a pit bull adoption fundraiser and silent auction at Mike's Smokehouse Barbecue and Grill. Again, it's the 18th of June, Saturday, 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. Be fun and games for both two and four leg types, and lots to eat and drink, music, silent auction, rolling raffle, proceeds to benefit Pitbull Happenings, Pitbulls to the Rescue, and Busters and Foster's Haven. So, Mike's Smokehouse Barbecue and Grill is located 7117 North Highway 301, Tampa, Florida. And to find out more, you could probably go to the Pitbull Happenings website. And on an international front, just as Whale Wars kind of resumed on Animal Planet last Friday, the season premiere. Other news from the Sea Shepherd juggernaut includes that activists of the group Sea Shepherd set sail from France on Wednesday with an unlikely destination, the waters of war-torn Libya. Their mission: stop any fishing for endangered bluefin tuna since it's illegal in those waters. Quote, any tuna fishing vessel we find off the Libyan coast will be operating illegally. Sea Shepherd's founder Paul Watson said in a statement, we will cut their nets, free the fish, and document and report their operations to international officials. We have no need to worry about Libyan planes or naval vessels, added Lockheed McLean, captain of the flagship Steve Irwin. We'll keep NATO forces aware of our activities. We can can't allow the poachers to profit from the war by taking these magnificent endangered fish. All right, I think that's going to do it for now for animal news and announcements. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Triumph, the insult comic dog, sort of the Dominic Strauss-Kahn of the showbiz canine world in some ways, and a guest many years ago on Talking Animals himself, with a piece called Call from Triumph's Son on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Hello? Yes. Son, yes. How are you, Spike? I'm sorry. Luther, yes, I knew that. Oh, your mom died, yes. Oh, that's very sad, yes. I'm sorry, you know, just refresh me, which one was your mom? She was a Pomeranian. Okay. Which one? She was brown and white. I'm sorry, more specific. A white spot on the left eye. Sorry, more specific. She had three legs. Okay. More specific, please. She could pee standing up. Didn't squat. Oh, yes, yes, I remember her, yes. She died. Oh, that's a loss for all of us, yes. That's sad. How old was she? That's right. Yes, she was experienced. Yes. There's going to be a burial. Good. So she's not going to be stuffed. One last time. You know what I'm saying? Sorry. You're the wrong person for that joke. Okay. Well, anyway, I'm not going to be able to make it. I have a show that night. Oh, no, I know you haven't told me the date. I just assumed you're burying her right away, yes? She's Jewish? Sorry. So, she's in a better place, yes, and, look, I really have to go. Stay in school and don't eat chocolate. What is it? You've written a script? You want me to look at it? Sure. Oh, I'm losing you. No, I'd be happy to. I'm going into a tunnel.
Oh, that Triumph. That was indeed Triumph the Insult Comic Dog with a piece entitled Call from Triumph's Son, taken from his album Come Poop With Me. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Andrew Westall, as I touched on earlier. He's the author, most recently, of The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, a true story of resilience and recovery, an often poignant account of his stint living as a volunteer at Fauna Foundation, a sanctuary just outside Montreal for chimpanzees retired from biomedical research. The book raises important questions about the cost benefits of research using chimpanzees, notes the restorative powers of a sanctuary like Fauna, and along the way we meet some pretty extraordinary chimps and humans. So let's now meet Andrew. With a reminder, we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Andrew Westall to Talking Animals. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Duncan.
Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, first let me congratulate you on the book. It's a measure, I think, of what a rare achievement the book is, that it's drawn high praise from both Jane Goodall and People magazine. So
right.
You don't always find them in the same thing. But it is, I have to say, I mean, it's beautifully written and sort of novelistic at times. And, you know, as you might imagine, I read a lot of animal-related books, not always for the show. And this, I just thought, was just really exceptionally well-written and well-done. So,
oh, thank you so much.
So given that the book and very likely our conversation today kind of, you know, largely centers around the Fauna Foundation. Maybe we could start by setting the scene a bit, asking you to just sort of describe the sanctuary a little bit more than my sort of cursory phrase in the introduction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the best way to do it would be to picture a 200-acre hobby farm with a sort of a maximum security building in the middle of it. Gloria Groh is the woman who founded Fauna, and she put all of her retirement savings with her partner, Richard, into building something called the Chimp House on her hobby farm. And it's this incredible building. It's filled with a labyrinth of tunnels and walkways and chimpanzee areas and also human areas, the kitchen and the walk-in fridge and everything.
Sure.
And that's where I spent much of my time. I spent 10 weeks volunteering at Fauna as a caregiver.
And so what sort of drew you there initially? I mean, what made you think, which I at least I believe that was the initial impulse, and if not, correct me if I'm wrong, but that, hey, this has the makings of a book if I sort of go and spend my 10 weeks helping out there.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be a primatologist, actually, before I became a writer.
Yeah.
I was training to do that. I spent a year living in the jungles of Suriname studying monkeys. And I knew just from that experience and from knowing enough about primates that chimpanzees are all individual personalities. And when I heard about Fauna, I'd known about Fauna for a while, but when I saw it popped back into my mind, I realized what an incredible cast of characters. What an amazing opportunity it would be to write a book that has a bunch of characters you really care for, but they're not human.
Yeah.
And then obviously I'd be able to get into their backstory and deliver a message that I think is a really important one.
Sure. Well, so with that thought in mind, I mean, I get the sense from reading the book that at some point, maybe not long after your arrival, mm-hmm. you probably had a sense of, wow, I thought I had a book here, and I do, but perhaps it's a more extraordinary book than I anticipated, richer in issues and emotions and just kind of all kinds of colors.
Yeah, exactly. It's I think it was just an amazing. The characters were so amazing to me. The level of and also the backstories that we had access to. And it was such an amazing opportunity to be able to get to know them on an individual basis and spend this time, you know, helping them was the most important thing. I mean, I knew there was a book there, but it was more that I should be there as a volunteer helping them and also realizing that it wasn't just yeah, I mean, basically just that mm-hmm. it wasn't a book that I had necessarily at first. I had to earn their trust and really develop a relationship with them first.
And so how did that work? I mean, you know, shortly after you got there and settled in a bit, I mean, what struck you most about them? I mean, you mentioned you have a background as a primatologist, but still, I mean, you know, these are apes far from probably what you saw in Suriname. I mean, I'm guessing you must have found certain things about these chimps at Fauna surprising for better and worse.
Yeah, I would say the two things struck me almost immediately were, first of all, the size and the power of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, when we think of a chimpanzee, we think of what we see in television commercials and movies.
Yeah.
And it turns out that those are babies. And when a chimpanzee gets to the age of 7, 8, 9, and then into its teens, it becomes a sub-adult and then an adult. And chimpanzees can be 7 times as strong as you or me. So, first of all, it was their power, the strength they had. They could be over 200 pounds, but also their incredible grace, the way they move, the way they're able to communicate with each other just through gestures, and the instances I witnessed of compassion and understanding, and understanding that their compatriots' sort of needs and fears are different than theirs, which is a huge cognitive ability that we now know that chimps possess. So it was this combination of sort of the incredible sound and strength and the feel of being surrounded by these huge animals in combination with their tenderness and their ability to care.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I mean, because the thing is, when we get a sense of that incredible strength and power when they are kind of, you know, beyond being babies and they are adults, mm-hmm. it's, you know, unfortunately, usually when you hear or read or find out about some horrible, horrible attack that's, you know, gone on, you know, one or more chimps have attacked a human. So, I mean, that's where you get the sense in the awful way about their incredible power. And I guess sort of related to that, maybe you could talk a little bit about it seems like the almost, in ironclad rule of no touching the chimps.
Oh, yeah.
Ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, fauna is, there's always the potential with chimpanzees for dangerous situations. Obviously, I'm not suggesting otherwise. And fauna, the last thing I'd want your listeners to think is that fauna is a place where people are cuddling up to a bunch of adult chimpanzees. It's not the case at all. It's an incredibly safe, secure environment for the chimpanzees and for the humans. But there is no visitor is allowed to touch a chimpanzee. I was not allowed to touch a chimpanzee. And there's always caging between us and them. That said, because they're so intellectually advanced, and you know, some of them are comedians and practical jokers,
mm-hmm.
you can still have great interactions with them this way. And I think the chimps have been there for so long now that they understand there are limitations in their relationships with humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's sort of a give and take in terms of that. We understand that, too, and we don't push the boundary.
Sure. Well, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Andrew Westhall, author of The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, A True Story of Resilience and Recovery. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Andrew a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. And just one thing that kind of popped in my mind just as a further measure of like how important that rule is. I mean, later in the book, you're sort of describing, you know, as you did along the way in your 10 weeks there, sort of connecting with the chimps, playing with the chimps, but there's sort of one longer scene towards the latter part of the book where you're really in a very, very playful, extended kind of encounter.
Yeah.
And there's this moment where, you know, that you could have touched, if it were allowed. And I think Gloria's kind of like, was sort of watching some of this. And even then it seemed like, where it would have been probably fine and safe. Even then she kind of said, nope.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I take my hat off to Gloria for her professionalism. I think it's really crucial that we keep these lines in the sand. Because what would happen to the sanctuary if something awful happened there?
Sure.
And I didn't want to be the one to cause that. And the event you're talking about is when Tom the chimpanzee presented to me to grab his fingers through the caging. And it was a momentous occasion for me on a number of levels. And I desperately wanted to. And I think we all would have in the same situation.
Yeah.
We all have this built-in need to connect with other primates and especially the great apes and especially chimpanzees, and it was incredibly hard to resist.
Yeah. And I guess just for some further context, I mean, you know, animal sanctuaries can be sort of complicated place. I mean, almost always a huge improvement for the animals over where they were before, where there was some, you know, a tiger who was living with some doofus in an apartment, or an elephant sprung from, you know, the multiple hardships of being on exhibit at a zoo or traveling in a circus. So they're comparatively idyllic places, very much including at Fauna, but Fauna and other chimp sanctuaries do kind of face unusual challenges by virtue of what the animals experienced and endured before they got there.
Yeah.
Can you sort of speak to that? Because, I mean,
absolutely.
I think that's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't touched on the backstory. Most of these chimpanzees came from a biomedical laboratory, which is where most of them were born. And in the lab, they were taken from their mothers just days before they were born. They were put in tiny cages. And for the next decades, they were infected with lethal human viruses and tested with vaccines. And they weren't allowed to socialize with others. So most of them were utterly traumatized by this experience. So the chimps at Fauna and the chimps in the other sanctuaries across the United States are all dealing with psychological in addition to the physical wounds from their experiences in the lab. So Gloria and her compatriots across the United States have had to develop this incredible ability to be one part custodian, one part caregiver, one part therapist to these chimpanzees. And it's such a long process. It takes years and years and years to break down that barrier between chimps and humans, because they have no reason to trust humans anymore. They've been injected and subjected to so many things at our hands that you can understand why they wouldn't trust us.
Yeah. Well, even one thing that as much as I feel like I kind of have a sense of how this works, and especially for chimps and biomedical research, but even the thing that you sort of pointed out is that even some that didn't go through as awful or harrowing a set of experiences, still the fact that anytime anything was going to happen, somebody would come along with a dart. A dart gun. So, you know, at a certain point, it doesn't take long to always be suspicious and not trust any human, regardless of if you've gone through really awful procedures or invasive things or not.
And even if they didn't go through all that stuff, the other thing is also mere captivity for an animal of that cognitive advancement is torture. And It is actually torture, and we know this now about the chimpanzees that have suffered it. There's chimpanzees at Fauna suffering from PTSD.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it makes tremendous sense that some animal experts have now formulated that theory. I mean, maybe you could sort of outline the key tenets of the findings by Gabe Bradshaw and others, because, I mean, once people sort of mention it, it's like, oh, my God, of course, that makes total sense.
Exactly. We draw these lines between us cognitively and psychologically, and we say they're so like us, but then we forget, well, if they're so like us, maybe they suffer like us as well. And mentally, there's a paper out a couple of years ago based on two chimpanzees who were both actually at Fauna. One of them has since passed away, named Jeannie, and the other is Rachel, who is still there. And Rachel's the most disturbed chimpanzee at Fauna mentally. She still goes through what I guess in a human you would refer to as a mental breakdown. Fairly often.
Mm-hmm.
And the one I witnessed, which was completely awful to witness, was an episode of floating limb syndrome, where someone who's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder will actually attack their own limb, thinking that it's a foreign object attacking them.
Yeah.
And this is not too dissimilar from things that humans experience who are suffering from PTSD. So the basic tenet of the paper is that the chimps who are coming out of labs, who are emerging from that darkness now, are suffering just as badly as a human prisoner of war, a human political prisoner, someone who's suffering from PTSD as we know it.
Yeah. And so what, as those findings have emerged, and maybe especially at Fauna, since the paper you cite is sort of based on two chimps there, I mean, how has that reshaped what Gloria and others, either at Fauna or at other sanctuaries for chimps that you know of, how has that kind of reshaped how they care for and just sort of monitor, I guess, even the behavior of their chimp charges?
I think what it's done is it's added a level of sensitivity and I'd even say delicacy to the way sanctuary directors run their operations. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is they need to be so sensitive to the mood and the feel in the room at any given time with animals that are so psychologically disturbed, because anything could set them off.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the most incredible things about Gloria Grow, is that she, over 13, 14 years, has developed this understanding that really does border on, really does parallel the human therapist relationship with a patient. And yet these animals can't speak to her in a language that we would recognize. They're speaking to her in other ways, with their bodies, with their gestures, with their actions among each other. And Gloria is trying to watch that and take lessons from it. Her whole staff is attuned to this. And I got to say, when I left Fauna and I walked in the front door of my apartment and I was greeted by my dog, I saw an entirely new individual before me. I was totally in tune suddenly with these other levels of emotion and communication coming to me from this animal I'd lived with for 3 years already.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt utterly bonded with him in a way that I've since lost, because I've been with him and I've slipped back into my old routines. And you know, I still feel quite bonded to the little guy. But
sure.
But it leaves a human is able to adapt and adjust their sensitivities to another species. It happens. It's happening at Fauna.
Yeah. Well, and also as far as Gloria Grow, I mean, it just seems like there are certain people you encounter in the animal world who are just so kind of unusually compassionate or saintly, even that they just sort of whatever happens around them and the people around them even is elevated. It's just like, you know, it's just sort of a singular kind of gift, as you're describing, for her to be, you know, and that came over time partly, but I'm sure she came into it with just that a special ability to be that attuned.
Absolutely.
And sort of react, you know, to the best ways for, as you say, the kind of growing delicacy.
Yeah, and it. I spent a lot of time in the book, or at least in my time at Fauna, wondering what it is. What is that secret ingredient in Gloria that has made her so compassionate towards another species? And I spent a lot of time sort of being hard on myself that I just couldn't go the whole way. I couldn't imagine living that life, committing my whole life to these chimpanzees. Then I realized further down the line that we all have our own gift to give. And mine, I think, is writing and narrative and storytelling. And that's where I found my role was best put. And maybe that's just me, you know, over-simplifying it, but or justifying
my ability. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, people who, you know, sort of are drawn to that world generally over time do find, hey, here's where I can be of most help. And I can't do what Gloria does, but maybe she can't, you know, put the pages together and the stories together the way I can.
Right,
and we all
exactly.
Kind of,
we all have our calling, I guess.
Yeah.
That's the way it works.
So, Andrew, there's a few folks here that have been holding. Let's take a call or two and get them involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Talking Animals with Andrew Restall.
Is that me?
Yes, it sure is. It's you. Did you have a question or comment for Andrew?
Yes, I was just wondering, have you ever had sex with a chimpanzee?
Okay, that's... Well, you know, it's so funny. I was just saying to someone that works here with me, because we don't screen the calls, Andrew, you might have already quickly gathered. But I said, you know, the first few years I'd get somebody calling to say, hey, what time is the concert over at Skipper's or some crazy thing? But I said, no, it doesn't really happen anymore. They're all kind of pretty well trained, and our listeners are really smart and cool. And so proven wrong here. Let's try. Let's gild the lily. Let's take one more. Hi, you're on Talking Animals, Talking Animals with Andrew Westall.
Hello.
Hi, it is
Hi.
You.
I'd like to ask Andrew, are the chimps mostly from Canada, or are they from Canada and the U.S.? Where are the majority of them from? And also about their living quarters in the winter, being familiar with that area.
Yeah.
How do they manage with the cold? Thank you.
Oh, great. Thanks so much for the call.
Those are great questions. Can you remind me what the first question was? Sorry.
Kind of to describe the living quarters for the chimps, and especially how that might be modified or changed when it gets into the harsher winter months.
Oh, and the citizenship. So I always say that the chimpanzees have dual citizenship. This is a cross-border story. They were taken from rescued from a laboratory in New York State, so they are, you know, technically American chimpanzees, if you can call them that. And then they were driven up north over the border to Montreal. So I consider them dual citizens. And they had a Canadian and an American flag hanging outside for a long while. And you're right about Montreal. It is a surreal thing to see chimpanzees in the snow. And they actually love it. And a couple of the chimps, I think it's Pepper, really loves the snow and loves going outside and playing with it. And sort of, she's very cautious with it. She's not sure what it is, but she has fun with it. Now, inside the chimp house, the temperature is almost that of a jungle. It's very humid. The floors are heated.
Mm.
It's incredibly thick in there. And it feels and smells and sounds like a jungle. Gloria's done an amazing job to make it feel that way. But again, some of the chimps do actually like going out into the winter cold. It's amazing to see.
Wow. So again, that's probably just an individual, you know, from chimp to chimp, they kind of respond.
Right.
Yeah. Well, again, this is Talking Animals. My guest is Andrew Westall, the author most recently of The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, A True Story of Resilience and Recovery. You can join the conversation by with a serious good question by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Well, before we get anywhere near the sort of real end of our time, Andrew, I want to be sure that we cover the Grade 8 Protection and Cost Savings Act,
yeah.
And just maybe, you know, what is it? How does it differ from the previous Grade 8 Protection Act? And maybe more to the point, what we can do to help and to help support its passage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing thing. There's a growing movement in the United States because the United States is the last country on Earth to still do this kind of research on chimpanzees. All the other countries have either outlawed it or always avoided it. So there's 1,000 chimps still locked up in laboratories across the country. And there's now the Grade 8 Protection and Cost Savings Act before both the House and the Senate. And what this act would do is it would retire all of the government-owned chimpanzees to sanctuaries, and it would outlaw this sort of invasive research on chimpanzees once and for all. It's an incredibly powerful piece of bill in terms of changing, making a real milestone in the way humans relate to the animal world. It would be the first time that a moratorium on research on a species has ever been made. It would be an expansion of the human moral circle farther than we've ever seen it before. And you can write your representatives and beg them to support the act. It's a very popular one on the Hill right now, apparently. It gets good bipartisan support, but you just never know. Politics is the fickle friend of public opinion, as we all know. So that's how you can help. You can try to get the Grade 8 Protection and Cost Savings Act passed. And you can also donate to Fauna Sanctuary or one of the other sanctuaries all across the United States. And you can find all that information at the back of my book and also on my website, andrewwestall.com.
And I should point out for those listening that Andrew Westall, it's WESTOOTOLL. So it's Andrew Westall, WESTOOLL.com. And the Fauna website is faunafoundation.org, at least in the... I guess there's two different sites depending on, again, which side of the border you're...
Yeah, so Americans can go to faunasanctuary.org,
mm-hmm.
And that's just the easier way for you guys to donate as well.
Okay, cool. And what do you think, Andrew, that are the prospects this time? Because I know there's been, you know, another version of this that seemed also promising to pass. I mean, do you feel like the way this one's been written, that the prospects are quite good? I know, like you say, from what I gather too, that, you know, there is a lot of support on the Hill.
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of timing and political will. I know, obviously, this last couple of years in the United States has not been easy from a government point of view and in terms of setting priorities. There's been a lot to do. I think what happens is these bills get introduced and they sit for 2 years, and if they don't actually come up for debate, if they're still in committee, then they actually have to be reintroduced the next time the Senate or the House reconvenes.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's been reintroduced a couple of times isn't the end of the world.
Sure.
Now they've changed the title. It used to just be Grade 8 Protection Act. Now they've added cost savings. The cost savings was always in the bill, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
It was always a matter of, look at the financial break we could give the American taxpayer by letting these chimpanzees out of the labs and into the sanctuary.
Sure.
But I think putting it into the title is more a political move than anything else.
Yeah, well, I mean, it comes down to smart marketing, perhaps.
Exactly.
Even. Yeah. All right. Well, let's hope people listening will feel inclined to contact their local representatives and just say, hey, we're all for it. And again, you can find out more at the websites that we have mentioned about the bill, andrewwestall.com, faunasanctuary.org, and elsewhere too. So there's all kinds of ways you can just search for it if you feel like, hey, well, I'd like to get some other stuff that maybe is even more objective, fact-based. Just, it's the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act. So you can get all kinds of information, including probably direct legislative analysis of it. So Andrew, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but you kind of alluded to Jeannie in a way. She's a fauna chimp, I should say, who had passed away before you arrived, but whose spirit and legacy kind of, you know, clearly infused the place. You could just sort of briefly tell us about Jean and what you learned about her and her influence, really.
Absolutely. Jeannie was Gloria's great love of her life. She had numerous mental breakdowns in the laboratory. She was the veterinarian who got the chimps out of the lab wasn't going to send Jeannie because she was too disturbed. And Gloria begged and begged and begged, and the lab technicians begged and begged and begged, and Gloria promised that she would build a place in the sanctuary called Jeannie's Room, which would be a place where she could have her own space. She could interact with humans if she wanted, but she could get away from the other chimps if she needed to. So she built this area, and the veterinarian did let Jeannie come to the sanctuary, and her remarkable improvement when she came to the sanctuary is outlined in the book. She's a central figure there. Her spirit really does live on, because now Rachel, the chimp I was telling you about before, she now lives in Jeannie's room.
Yeah.
She's there all the time in spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Andrew, actually over time, but I feel like we can't have a conversation about your book without spending at least 20, 30 seconds on Tom, just because, you know, he's pivotal also to the story and to your book, obviously. So.
Yeah. Tommy is the central character of the book, but also of the Great Ape Protection and Cost Savings Act. He's the face of the movement, and he was born in the wild and spent over 30 years in different laboratories, and then he was finally rescued, and he is Gloria's greatest teacher. He became the grandfather figure to all the other chimpanzees. He was the first one to submit to Gloria's ministrations with medical supplies for a cut on his foot. Mm-hmm. All the other chimps learned from him that the humans are there to help them, not to hurt them.
Yeah.
And he really broke through a lot of the ice between the chimps and the humans at Fauna.
Yeah. Well, you can find out more about him and all these other things by picking up a copy of Andrew's book, The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, A True Story of Resilience and Recovery. Andrew, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And again, the website for Andrew himself is andrewwestall, WESTOLL.com. And again, great, great book. Congratulations. Thanks again for making the time for us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. There'll be a prize, in fact, a copy of Andrew's book, Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, chosen with Andrew's book, or at least the subject matter in mind. In a moment, we'll speak with Catherine Doyle, In Defense of Animals Elephant Campaign Director. Right now, though, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. right. Well, if someone happens to know that and wants to make a guess, we'll take that off the air. But right now, we want to introduce Catherine Doyle, who's, as I mentioned earlier, with In Defense of Animals. She's the Elephant Campaign Director, and she's been on the show before, and we're happy to have her back on right now. Catherine, welcome.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you today?
Good, good. Welcome or welcome back, I should say. So first let's do maybe just a quick overview, even though you have been on the show in the past, of In Defense of Animals. What is it and what does it do?
Okay, well, we're an international animal protection organization. We cover a variety of issues affecting animals. And we also have rescue facilities in Mumbai, India, and in Cameroon, Africa. And also a rescue facility in Mississippi.
Wow. All right. Well, that's covering the globe in various ways. So, as I mentioned a moment ago and earlier in the show too, you're the organization's Elephant Campaign Director. What does that involve?
Oh boy.
All right. Well,
what doesn't it involve?
Okay. Well, what's a slice of what it involves? How about that?
Okay. A slice of what it involves is. Well, a big part of it is education, and it's about educating the public about the suffering of elephants in zoos and why they're suffering, which of course is due to the inadequate, conditions for them, such as, lack of space, inadequate social conditions, even climate. We have elephants who are kept in cold climates where during the winters they spend the vast majority of their time indoors in these very small, stalls, a lot of times standing on concrete that just really destroys their feet and joints.
All right. So it sounds like really it's a pretty broad what the job description is, and it sounds like it probably shifts often driven by events like Saturday, which we'll get into more specifically in one sec, or situation that arises at a zoo where there's a particular issue maybe with an elephant I guess I could ask you that tomorrow or a week from today, and you might have a different answer what the job kind of
definitely. Yeah. In fact, we're focusing on campaigns across, around the United States, sometimes internationally. And, there's always a lot going on with elephants. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Zoos and circuses.
Right. Well, so let's find out more specifically then about the International Day of Action for Elephants in Zoos. What are its kind of chief objectives?
Okay. Well, again, the chief objective is really to educate the public and to share information with them, because most people just don't realize, like I said, that elephants are so severely affected by the conditions that they're living in. In fact, elephants are not thriving in zoos, no matter how skillful the care that's given elephants, zoos just can't compensate for keeping them, these giant animals in small and natural exhibits that are causing them to suffer and die prematurely.
Yeah, well, as I think a few weeks back we had Ron Kagan on the show who, for both things, really, kind of that you've mentioned now in two different answers, though, but between the climate and just the general conditions of he's at the Detroit Zoo, but just even beyond that, just starting to realize more and more that, that even if you were in a more climate-friendly place, a zoo is just really not a place to, confine an elephant that roams, all day and is part of huge, huge social groups, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, you're talking about the Earth's largest land mammal that can walk, on average 7 to 14 miles a day. And, and it isn't just about two. In fact, it's kind of interesting because a lot of times zoos will say, well, we feed them, we give them shelter, and, they don't have to walk around, to find food or water. But the fact is, I know, it's ridiculous. It's like saying that we would be perfectly happy sitting on a couch, and not having to move. I don't know, maybe some people would, but you wouldn't be very healthy mentally or physically for very long,
Right.
And the truth is elephants are adapted. They're physically adapted for movement. And elephants, they are wild animals. I mean, most of the elephants that you see in, the great majority that you see in zoos and in circuses were actually captured in the wild. And so, there's no such thing as a domesticated elephant. So you were talking about anytime you see an elephant, even one born here, that is a wild animal that still has these very innate needs. They need to move. They have these long legs. They're adapted for movement, They have these long legs to, take them across these great expanses of land. They've developed, communication across long distances. I mean, it's just, And of course, you know, they live in these large family groups, and even, you know, and their societies even encompass, you know, hundreds of elephants.
Yeah, so let me ask at least one, if not more, kind of rhetorical, if not maybe at some point devil's advocate type question. Is there a zoo environment that you either know of or that you could even imagine that would ever make sense for an elephant, given what you've just told us about their needs and kind of their, you know, what their general lives are like when they're not in captivity?
Right. Yeah, well, certainly, really, the facilities that are setting the standard for the care of elephants in captivity, because, you know, face it, we have elephants in captivity. We need to, you know, take the best care of them possible. And that would be the elephant sanctuaries. And there's the elephant sanctuary in Tennessee and the Paw Sanctuary in Northern California, both of which provide, you know, large expanses of land for elephants, you know, hold them in social groups, and where they have access, year-round access to the outdoors and to fresh vegetation. Very important.
Right. And here's where I kind of at least hinted, if not to, you know, caution that I get into a devil's advocate thing, but I just think for a lot of people that are hearing about this, maybe thinking about this. So here's the thing. If they, you know, they have kids, they have a family and they want to, you know, they grew up like, you know, having some kind of, you know, experience with elephants and they like elephants, but now it's like, hey, well, don't go to the zoo to have that kind of experience with an elephant. And usually, I think there's a few exceptions, maybe at least at one of those sanctuaries. I mean, those sanctuaries typically do not allow the public in. So other than, you know, saying, hey, well, on a DVD or some sort of virtual experience, I mean, what would you say to someone who says, well, I, you know, how then do I commune with, or how does my little kid or kids commune with an elephant?
Well, what I would say is that you really have to look at it from the elephant's point of view, which is, well, first of all, okay, even before I get to that, first of all, you have to look at, you know, how often are you really going to see that elephant? I mean, that's something I was, you know, point out to people is that, you know, maybe someone goes to the zoo once, maybe twice a year, they're going to spend a couple minutes in front of that elephant, yet, and then they go home. They go home to their comfortable, you know, lives.
Yeah.
And that elephant really is spending their entire lives, you know, within that zoo, really for your maybe 5-10 minutes a year. And
yeah.
So if you look at it from the elephant's point of view, you know, this is not, like I said, it's just, there's just no justification. Like I said, people like to see elephants, you know, granted, I mean, there's, you know, they do.
Sure.
But you just can't justify your 10 minutes a year. You can't justify keeping them in these inadequate conditions that are causing them to suffer and die prematurely. Like I said, for your 10 minutes a year to go see them.
Sure.
And as far as, you know, if you really want to educate your child about elephants, I'll tell you, what you see in zoos is not education.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, you can see how big they are, what color they are, you know, but you're not going to learn about everything I just talked about long distance communication. They're, you know, they're fascinating, you know, complex societies, you know, just the fact that they're self-aware. I mean, it's just, there's so much more. Elephants are just so much more than an animal that you see standing pretty sedentary in a zoo.
Yeah.
And then in which there's people around, you know, I mean, if you've been to the zoo, you know, kids are, you know, yelling at the animal, you know, trying to get them to move or to do something. And the fact is, elephants naturally, you know, are on the move all the time, 20 hours a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in zoos, what you see, that's not an education. That's actually, you know, it's just not good information about elephants. It's not quality information. I'll tell you, a good documentary, you know, a good book is going to give you way better education about elephants.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's really good. And I think that the 10 minutes, you know, answer, because I, you know, anytime I have an elephant expert on, I sort of ask that question or a variation of it, because, you know, I mean, that's what you hear usually from people who are saying, oh, I didn't know that, but I don't see how I could not go to the zoo or take my family to the zoo. But I think if you, you know, think about it in that 10-minute thing that you responded, it's like, well, how selfish are you really, you know,
yeah,
for your 10 minutes? But, so, okay, so let me quickly say that as I mentioned earlier in the show, International Day of Action for Elephants and Zoos has a very local element at the Lowry Park Zoo from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. And
on Saturday, right?
Yeah, this Saturday, June 11th, right?
Saturday, yeah.
Yeah. So, again, people, they'll provide signs and flyers if you'd like to show up for that a little bit before 10 a.m. And also, before I let you go, Catherine, I think we should talk at least briefly about this bullhook ban in Fulton County.
All right. Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, in a nutshell, it's a great win for the elephants. It only applies to a certain part of the county and a certain unincorporated part of the county. So it doesn't affect Ringling Brothers, for example, going to Atlanta. However, it will affect, you know, smaller circuses going into that area.
Yeah.
But really what is the importance of it is this is another great step forward for elephants because
sure.
bullhooks need to be banned everywhere. In fact, you know, about half of zoos are still using bullhooks, which is really incredible in this day and age. You're talking about, you know, a bullhook is a weapon. It, you know, it looks like a fireplace poker. It's a heavy steel rod with a point, you know, at the end and a hook. And really it's used to, you know, prod into hook and even strike the elephants. And even when it's not being used, it's a weapon of intimidation. It really is. I mean, these elephants, you know, they're self-aware. They're intelligent. They know the consequences of not complying with a command, and the consequence can be physical punishment with that bullhook.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, slowly if we just get those out of people's hands, starting in Fulton County and beyond, you know, that's all in the name of progress. So, Catherine, we actually went way over our time, but it was you, yeah. and we're talking about elephants. I couldn't really help myself. So thanks again for making the time to join us, and we'll keep track on developments through you and have you on again, of course, down the road and talking animals.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And also, if anyone wants more information, www.helpelephants.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Catherine.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday. And again, this month, June, in fact, next Wednesday will be almost 8 years to the day since we launched Talking Animals. So it'll be a huge gala celebration. Not really. But nonetheless, I hope you'll join me then. So visit our website, talkinganimals.net. We make available all sorts of information as well as archives and podcasts, past Talking Animals programs. Broadcast outreach consultant for the show is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls version of It's the Music, airing next, noon to 3, closing out today's show. Well, we would have if we had time, with Bare Naked Ladies, with Chimp Song, another postcard. But right now, it's NPR News, WNF Tampa.